Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of RealCom Live. Great to be back with you. Been a busy week. Before we actually get into this week's episode, just a quick recap of what we've been up to. We headed to Austin, Texas this week and put on our third hybrid event. It was a smaller invitation-only event, but nonetheless, we had about 20 or so people in the room and about 40 people, kind of the size of the venue that we were looking for. And I got to tell you, it was nerve-wracking right up to the very end of the morning when we finally figured it out. And I will tell you now that after doing three of them, we really have a good understanding of what hybrid means. We rented a studio. We had all sorts of folks there assisting and bringing people in from all over the world and into the studio. And the reason we're doing this is we believe that in the long run, hybrid is going to be the way we're all going to go back to work and back to the mall and basically back to everywhere. I think that real estate and technology are really coming together in ways never before imagined. We're going to be bringing everything we've learned in the last three to our event in November. So we're excited, a little tired, a little stressful, but a great week. And now looking forward to a great conversation with our guest, Marty Edwards. So this week, we're back to the topic of cyber. It's important. We can't get away from it. Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Jim, for inviting me on today.
Absolutely. As you know, unfortunately, it's defense. I would prefer playing offense and figuring out all these cool new things as it relates to smart buildings and next-gen workplaces. But we have to take a pause a little bit too often, I have to say, to talk about defense and specifically cybersecurity. So we go way back. And you know, right now, you're the VP of OT security for Tenable. But you were also, I understand, the longest-serving director of the ICS cert group within the federal government, which we're going to talk about in a second. But most importantly, at least from my standpoint, and I believe you were the person who told me when the lights in the Super Bowl went off that one year, your phone rang. Was that you?
Yeah, I remember that one pretty well. You know, there was a group of us that were actually watching the Super Bowl and all in the same sort of career field, right? All working for the federal government. And when the lights went off, we basically all took our phones out and put them on the table and said, okay, what are the odds on whose phone's going to ring first? And I either lost or won that, depending on how you look at it.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think that'll give the guests a little idea of your career. And I know cyber is big today, and it's getting, you know, to be a very important topic, but I think it's also important to talk to folks who've been at this for a while, because you've got the benefit of seeing how this thing has developed over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So if you wouldn't mind, just take a couple minutes and give us your career. You can all go all the way back to university, and how the heck did you get to be one of the most, you know, sought after cyber folks in the US right now?
Yeah, so I started basically, I went to a specialty university college in British Columbia, Canada, called the British Columbia Institute of Technology. And my training is all in control systems. So, you know, the computers that run all of our critical infrastructure, PLCs and all of the SCADA and all the different actual industrial control system components. So that's what I'm trained in. Started to work primarily in pulp and paper in Western Canada, Washington State, Idaho, became the senior control system engineer at a fairly large pulp and paper facility. My boss also happened to be the guy who ran all of the PC networks. So we were kind of a weird hybrid 20 years ago.
I was going to say, how long ago was that?
I started there in 99. So that was 21 years ago. Wow. And essentially, we had all of the IT and all of the OT reporting into the same group. So I ran the OT. There was I had a colleague that ran the IT side of the house. And that got me interested in security more and more. And so I started going to some of the early events run by people like Eric Byers, who is a good personal friend of mine, that were, you know, literally the very first events in the world to talk about OT and control system security.
What year was that? What year would that have been?
That would have been in like the 2003-ish time frame, 2002-ish, right after
So you're
9/11.
way ahead of this. So you're way ahead of this.
Yeah, so 9/11 was kind of a catalyzing moment in the cybersecurity field in that a lot of us kind of went, oh, wow, people can attack us with airplanes. Maybe they can attack us with computers. So we started to get more involved, and one thing led to another, and I basically got recruited by the US government to join their Department of Energy Idaho National Laboratory. And I led some of their control system efforts there in about the 2006 time frame. And
Now,
then
was this just control systems in general or from a cyber perspective?
only cyber. So this
Only
was
cyber. Wow.
specific to control system security. And so the predecessor of the ICS cert was a program called the Control Systems Security Program at DHS. And so I was the contractor that basically ran all of the work for that program for my federal bosses, basically in DC. Then DHS tapped me on the shoulder and they said, "We really don't want you to be a contractor. We'd prefer if you could work for DHS as a federal employee." And so that's when they offered me the job of director of the ICS cert. And I was the last director of the ICS cert. So when I left Homeland Security, that position no longer exists, and that organization basically got rolled into what is now called CISA.
So, we could unpack what you just said for hours, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that in 1999, OT and IT were under the same umbrella. That should be a Harvard case study. We have been preaching that, pitching that, yelling that, screaming that for 20 years now. What, just to pivot back real quick, what made that what decision happen? Was it an individual? Was it a very smart organization? How did that come to be?
I think it was essentially it was driven by an individual who was my boss at this pulp mill. Pulp and paper mills, are very operationally oriented. So we were a little bit separate from corporate. Corporate was in Spokane. We were in Idaho, and so we basically made sure that all of the PCs on people's desks that needed to get data out of the control system, right? So they had access to what was the water temperature that was coming in from the river or going out to the river? What were the, natural gas flows to the boilers? What was the production off the paper machines? This is the data that the people in the offices
We're
that were
using,
the
yeah.
managers were using on a day-to-day basis. So it made sense that the same group maintained those systems. And some of the first work I did was essentially to segment off some of the more sensitive industrial control system environments from the corporate or the enterprise environments. And that,
Yeah,
I
you
think,
could, yeah.
really sort of was catalyzing a moment for me to put me on that path to security.
Yeah, if you think about it though, as we move into a more integrated world between the front end and the back end, there's no way around integrating IT and OT organizations. And yet we still have a number of them who are resistant to it, unfortunately.
And Jim, people say they're not integrated. People say that they're not connected, but they're connected. I mean, there
No,
are
I know they are.
very
The technology is integrated. Yeah,
there's some very
I get that,
specific
yeah.
cases that they have the isolation in place, but they're moving data in and out of these networks, whether it's with USB sticks or something like that. So there's some type of
Correct.
connections.
Oh no, I understand the technical side. I'm saying organizationally, there's still a resistance for IT and OT to sit in the same room under an umbrella and work together. Yeah, I agree with you on the tech side. It's
Yeah.
more the organization. All
And
right, pivoting a little bit.
organizations are coming better, are coming closer together as well. So
Absolutely.
I see a lot of
Absolutely.
good work there.
Absolutely. We've watched it over the last 20 years. I just wish it would have happened. The organizational alignment would have happened a little sooner. So where are we today? All the attacks, we've had a number of guests on in the last couple of months. If 12, midnight or 12 noon is the doomsday, right? As we used to have in the doomsday clock, where are we with OT cybersecurity in North America right now? How close to 12?
It's a really hard question to answer, and it's one that I'm asked all the time, right? And I think it really depends on the organization's maturity. So we have some organizations that are doing a really good job of OT security, right? They've got the people in place, they've got the technology in place, they've got the governance in place, and they're paying attention. But I think for the most part, we still have a long ways to go. So if you want to talk about doomsday or the threat, I see this ransomware threat just continuing to increase and increase. I mean, as long as we are paying ransoms, criminals are going to be attracted to that area because, it's like the bank robber, right? They ask the bank robber, "Hey, why'd you rob banks?" It was, "Well, that's where the money is." So guess what? The money's in ransomware right now. And I think it's only a matter of time before we see these ransomware attacks directly impacting these OT and ICS environments. If you look at Colonial Pipeline and JBS and things like that, the ransomware impacted enterprise operations, right? It directly impact industrial operations. They
Right.
chose to shut their industrial operations down, either out of safety or more likely is because they have access to the tools they needed on the corporate network. So people don't understand that. If you're an operator, you need to look at a procedure manual. Well, guess what? That procedure manual is in a software program on the corporate network, right? So
That's
if you
right.
don't have the procedure to do the job safely, you have to shut down. But I think it's only a matter of time before the criminals start attacking and targeting the industrial environment directly just because there's more money there.
Well, and I know you may not want to or be in a position to answer this question, but is there a direct line or a dotted line from these career organization or criminal organizations to nation states that don't like us? I mean, is there a relationship there?
There is a relationship, but I think it's more kind of the nation state. And in the case of most of these criminal ransomware operations, it's Russia and former Soviet countries, right? So I think it's just a case of those entities turning a blind eye to the criminal activity that's happening, right? It's a good training ground. They can hire people out of there. It's keeping people employed, sort of thing. So they turn a blind eye to it. Thankfully, I'm seeing more diplomacy and more discussions on the world stage where, we really do have conversations happening with countries like Russia that they're starting to warm up to the sort of taking a harder line against criminal activity inside their countries. So I think it's just basically becoming better stewards or better global citizens, if you want to call it that.
Right. And then from, and again, this is, I'm sure, is an opinion, but going back to the malware issues that we saw in the last, 2 months, the breaches, should they have paid that ransomware? I mean, I know that's a not an easy question to answer, but at the high level, I mean, does it make sense to pay the bad guys?
It's a really difficult question. And unfortunately, what a lot of people don't understand is it's a question that really only the CEO or the board of directors with fiduciary responsibility for the company can answer, right?
Right.
So, I mean, in general, governments, law enforcement agencies, in general, people will say, do not pay the ransom. You're funding a criminal enterprise. You are basically just continuing to make it more attractive for the criminals, right? Because there's more money in that pool. However, if you're a company that may not have the greatest backups or you have even the slightest chance of stopping some proprietary data leak or some confidential data leak happening, and you balance the cost of what that data leak would cost you, which could be
Right.
in the hundreds of millions of dollars, with a ransom payment that is in the single millions or maybe in the tens of millions of dollars, you can't really second guess their decision
No,
to pay the ransom at
that's
that
fair.
time. Now you couple that in with some cyber insurance policies that will cover the ransomware payment, and now you've got it. Well, hey, this is going to be covered under insurance. Luckily or thankfully, we now have insurance companies sort of looking again at those policies and going, you know what? We're not going to pay for ransomware payments. So they're specifically going to cut those out of some of those
Which is
policies.
going to change the whole dynamics of the conversation.
So
Yeah.
I mean, it's an easy question to answer. I think from a policy perspective, government policy perspective, yeah, the policy don't pay the ransom. But there may be edge cases where if you've got a hospital or a critical infrastructure or something like that that's not functioning because of this, and there's a chance you can get it back up and running, it's like a hostage situation, right? Sometimes you have to pay the money.
Yeah. Well, we had a hospital in San Diego, Scripps, four or five different hospitals impacted. They did not pay, at least that I know of. I haven't followed in the last couple of weeks, but they tried to figure it out themselves or continuing to try to figure it out themselves, but I believe they did not pay the ransom.
Well, and the way I look at it, Jim, is if a company has good disaster and recovery procedures, so you're taking backups of all your data, you're testing those backups, you're exercising your disaster recovery plan, you know exactly what you're going to tell the media, you know exactly what you're going to tell your shareholders when it happens. You've got, you know, you're going to be transparent about it to the press. So you know exactly what you're going to say. If you've got all those things, it's not much different than handling a fire, right? If a fire comes in and destroys your data center, how are you going to recover from that? And can you recover within a day or two?
Yeah. We've been doing business continuity and disaster recovery planning at our events for 20 years, always the least populated rooms at the conference. I suspect in the future, they may become some of the most crowded rooms at the conference.
It's a huge area, you know, but now ransomware is getting more complicated, right? So now you have this sort of concept of double extortion. So not only are they locking up your computer and holding your computer for ransom, but they're taking your data and then they're extorting you by telling you they're going to leak that data online. And quite often, the ransomware payment is to try and prevent them leaking that data online. But can you trust it?
I was part of the Blue Cross Blue Shield breach 8-9 years ago. So my health data is floating out there someplace. Yeah. All right. We got to take a quick break. We will be back in 30, 60 seconds. And I got a couple more questions for you. All right. Let's continue our conversation with Marty Edwards. All right. So we go all the way back to, you know, 1999, early 2000s, your career. You're one of the few people focusing on this. Let's fast forward to the last 12 months where we've seen more public display of, you know, breaches and cybersecurity instances reported in newspapers, you know, more of a mainstream conversation. It's gotten pretty bad in the last 6 months. What can we expect in the next 24? Is it going to get worse, better? I mean, what should we expect? You're on mute. Hold on 1 second.
Oh, sorry about that.
We got you.
So I don't see how it possibly could get better. I mean, I think that following on this criminal ransomware conversation, you know, the criminals there's blood in the water, so to speak, right? So they're going to keep pounding away at this. And I think coupled with that is actually a good thing, though. And the good thing is that I believe companies are getting more transparent about sharing when they've had a breach or sharing when they've had an incident. And I applaud them because I actually believe, and I think the data shows, that a company who is transparent from the get-go and is clear what is happening and what their plan is to get back up and running, they perform the best in the long haul, right? Over and over again, where companies try to sort of sweep things under the rug, they get called to the carpet for that after the fact. So, you know, I think it's going to continue to get worse for a while, unfortunately.
So the building industry, you know, in many respects, just thinks it can't happen to them, or, you know, we're low profile, we're low risk. We've got a building in the Middle East that has been just shut down, wrapped in cellophane and shut down. All the systems, elevators, access control. I mean, you know, literally one of the most, I'd say, aggressive OT attacks for malware, you know, in the building world, right? Not necessarily factories or big industrial facilities. What do you say to the average building owner? And then I'm going to say, what do you say to the high profile building owners? You know, those big projects in Manhattan and in Chicago and LA, these high profile buildings. First of all, what do you say to just the average building owner who might not think they're at risk? And then second of all, what do you say to the high-profile building owners that really could have a target on their back?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing that I say to any segment, and the building segment is no different, is that for the most part, this equipment that you're running, the stuff that's running the elevators or running the fire safety system or running, your energy management systems, lighting controls, et cetera, this is exactly the same equipment that has been involved in some of these other attacks in other verticals, right? So just because you're not in the power grid or just because you're not an oil and gas company doesn't mean that you're not using very, very similar or not exactly the same equipment, right? So there's some risk associated just with that common supply chain. The next thing I would say is, all computerized devices seem to be a risk these days, right? So you have to take this seriously. In some cases, these criminal organizations aren't really doing surgical targeting. They're doing what we call spray and pray, right? They're just pushing stuff out there, hoping to get a victim. And if that victim happens to be your heating, ventilating, and air conditioning controls, within your building, then you're stuck, right? So I don't buy the argument that we're not a target. I think everybody is a target through sort of collateral associations. And then the high value targets, I mean, buildings that house, data centers or high profile companies or government operations, any sort of critical infrastructure affiliation, those are going to be on the high value target list for a criminal organization, right? Because they know that they can get more money out of them from these extortion techniques.
Well, if you just break down the whole, cyber phenomena over the last 20, 25 years, it starts with very sophisticated military government organizations that have money and resources to focus on these really sophisticated things. Then all of a sudden it drops down into the criminal, element, right? Who's saying, hey, we can make money at this, right? So they now have the money and the interest of investing in resources to do these kinds of things. But as this thing progresses, you're going to get all the way down to disgruntled employees and young kids hacking out of their bedroom for fun, right? And so as the tools get more out there and this becomes more gamified, if you will, I think you could, as a homeowner, you could need to worry about your next door neighbor who might be, hacking your router versus somebody who's looking to attack a major building in New York City because it'll draw a lot of attention,
Yeah. Jim, it's interesting that you took the approach of going kind of from the top down from a sophistication perspective, right? Usually when I explain it, I look at it from the bottom up. We've seen hacking sort of as a as something to do to just to show the weaknesses in these devices that has kind of grown in sophistication over the years. But there is no doubt that a lot of these sort of criminal operators now are doing this as a service. So ransomware as a service. And don't underestimate these organizations. They have
I
tech
know.
support
They
hotlines.
have tech
They
support,
patch
yeah.
their software. They have accounts, they have financial operations that will help move the money back and forth. I mean, they have payroll, they have personnel.
All right, well,
They're like
for
small.
our next conversation, you need to find me a couple of these and we're going to go to the websites, take screen caps, and show them on this show because I'm thinking people are sitting there going, are you, I know this exists, but some of the folks listening may not. Yes, ransomware as a service. It is a business enterprise.
It is a business enterprise and it's available to buy basically. So the really sophisticated software developers that there's only a few of in the world perhaps, they write this elaborate code, but then they sell it to other criminal groups, right? And so the other criminal groups are the ones who are doing the actual targeting, and then they of course split sort of the proceeds.
Well, the message I'd like to get out of today's show is whether or not you're the janitor, the receptionist, middle management, all the way to the CEO, awareness has to be risen. We have to watch that fine line between insight and paranoia, right? Because you don't want to be worried about this all the time. But you got to pay attention and you have to take some time and energy to protect your own personal environment, your departmental environment, your company environment, and for guys like you, our country, right? I think it's a call to everybody to pay a little more attention to this and to ask good questions and keep your eyes open. So
Absolutely.
All right, we are unfortunately out of time. You and I could talk for hours, and it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. We're going to have you back. We're going to continue this conversation, and we certainly hope to see you in November in Phoenix, Scottsdale, when we get back in person, because we're going to be holding the CIO or the Cyber Forum, as we have for the last five, 6 years, whatever. So we're going to be back at that, and you're an important part of that conversation. So thank you for being on today, and look forward to continuing our conversations.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure, Jim.
Okay. Be well. Take care. All right. Now on to one of my favorite segments of the show. Howard Berger is going to tell us what the heck is happening this week in prop tech news or real estate tech, whatever we're going to call it this week. It's all yours, Howard.
Oh, hey, thanks, Jim. Hey, and thanks, Marty. Great conversation this week. So as we do every week, we highlight a couple of stories from our news briefing that's released every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And our lead article is from Kurt Emshausen. He's former CAO at Transwestern, now principal consultant at Emshausen Group. He's focused on data strategy. And I think it's apparent our industry at large is starting to wake up to the value of data. But relatively few organizations have really embraced a holistic strategic enterprise data strategy. How many companies really know the square footage of their portfolios? Or what's in their leases when they expire? This is basic 101 stuff. But alarmingly few companies have even evolved to a rudimentary data strategy. And it's going to get much more complicated post-pandemic. Are you going to hope to apply the calculus necessary to figure out how do you respond to all the pressures you're going to be faced with hybrid, flex, remote working policies, and understand how to integrate those into your portfolio? So in this article, Kirk makes a great cogent argument for building the team's capabilities necessary to build a comprehensive data strategy. So you can navigate the turbulent waters ahead. Great article. Next, shout out to this week's technology partner in Pixon, Leading Voice and Indoor Mapping Intelligence and Analytics. There's a great case study involved by Chris Weigand, EVP from Pixon. Please hit that article. And a few interesting tidbits from this week's news. Australian prop tech firm Propic join forces with MRI Software to rescue overstressed property managers from burnout with their conversational AI. It's going to enable service providers to communicate with clients via automated conversational or text AI for a lot of the normal management tasks. Also, Yardi just introduced Facility Manager combined with their Pulse fault detection for HVAC systems. That's going to enable property and facility managers to preemptively address equipment failures and automate the work order creation when a fault's detected. Watch the brief video in the article. And then finally, shout out to our longtime RealCom advisor and friend, Sandy Jackalow, who's just appointed Chief Information Officer at DLP Real Estate Capital and has joined their senior technology team in St. Augustine, Florida. Congratulations on your new dig, Sandy. Hope you brought plenty of sunscreen. So unfortunately, I'm out of time. That's it for me today, but there's a lot more in our weekly briefing. Check it out, and I'll see you all next week.
Great job, as Howard. You take that funnel, you take a million articles, you get it down to a 10 or so, you focus on the top three. A very efficient way to get the high level prop tech stories out. A lot of bad stuff out there you have to sift through. A lot of junk. Thank you so much. All right. Before I wrap up, let's hear from our final sponsor, Tempered Networks. All right. And as you can see, a lot of our sponsors this week devoted to securing buildings. So what I would like to do is say thank you. Number one, to Marty. I know how busy your day is, and finding some time for us means a lot. Number two, to our sponsors, who I just mentioned, for keeping us going on RealCom Live. And finally, to our back-end team who makes this happen every week, Nancy and crew, thank you. And next week, another great conversation, two really true domain experts, John Petsy and Mark Petock, two of the co-founders of Project Haystack, are going to be here with us talking about data standards, where Haystack is, all the great work it's done over the last couple of years, where it's going next. A show you're not going to want to miss if you're serious about all the data coming out of that smart building and how to protect it and how to standardize it. So with that, everybody have a great weekend, and we look forward to seeing you next week on RealCom Live. Be well.